This is an encore edition of Yin Radio, originally aired in October 2008, and it's extremely appropriate for these last days of summer, when we're getting those outings, getting out into the woods, getting into the great outdoors. It's called Explorations.
Carolyn Pachuzel has often gone on adventure outings with the girls in her family, her mom and her sisters. Last August, Carolyn shared the joy of women's outings with a larger group. She organized a women's backpacking and riding trip. It was open to the first 10 or so women who signed up. Carolyn recruited riding instructors and found two volunteers, both on the faculty at Washington State University, Debbie Lee and Andrea Clark Mason. The group of 11 women headed out to the Wallowa Mountains in Oregon, out into the Eagle Cap Wilderness, to camp and to hike and to write. Some 2 months later, the women gathered to share their writing with each other and with us. This show comes from their reading at Book People in Moscow on October 25th, 2008. Here's how instructor Andrea introduced it.
Thank you all so much for coming tonight. To the Exploring Wilderness, Exploring Ourselves, Women's Backpacking, and Writing, Reading.
With that, I call today's show Explorations. This is Yin Radio, coming to you from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. The place to start is at the beginning, with Harriet Aiken. She was the first to read her work, and it was an appropriate piece to start with. She wrote about preparing for the trip. Here's Harriet Aiken.
Okay. All right. Mine is, "Wow, that was fun," or "The Inadvertent Successes of a 61-Year-Old Female Trekker." So there I was, absentmindedly staring at a flyer announcing a backpacking trip while awaiting my turn for the cashier. The flyer was promoting a trip into the Eagle Cap Wilderness coming up in 3 weeks. All women, a good thing for a 61-year-old woman planning to return to backpacking after a 20-year pause. Ho! It was a group of women writers. This would be something special. My need to be in hyperspud had all gotten started when my friend Louise had announced that she wanted to spend 5 weeks walking across Spain from the Pyrenees to the Atlantic. Without too much thought, I decided I wanted to do this too. Being half Norwegian, I had always had the vague feeling that walking is encoded in my DNA in some way, like knitting. Having decided that I needed to do some preparation for a 500-mile walk that would take me over two mountain ranges, walking an average of 15 to 16 miles per day, carrying my needs on my back all the way, I did what every serious adventurer does. I went to the internet. Oh boy, books about walking. And there have been three more editions of The Complete Walker since the original 1968 edition. In the 1970s, I had read all of Colin Fletcher's books and had used The Complete Walker as my inspirational and practical guide. Upon finding TCW, I had joined REI and started to accumulate equipment. So I ordered the Complete Walker 4 from Amazon and anxiously awaited its arrival. In the meantime, my friend Megan told me that her husband had worked at Hyperspud while he was at UI and that he thought highly of the expertise of John, the owner. My new The Complete Walker, having arrived, I was getting fired up with the concept of ultralight. So off I went to talk with John about this. Bless his heart, he spent what must have been to him an endless time instructing me in the esoteria of ultralight. There were the sleeping bags hanging on their hangers, gleaming brilliantly in all their iridescence like a row of scarab beetles. And there were the internal frame packs in lovely pastel colors and weighing less than the dollars it took to buy them. Because this was a reconnaissance trip, I just gathered this information and bought only a nifty little waterproof stuff sack and socks that are waterproof but breathable. I went home quite excited about all this. I immediately weighed my old down sleeping bag, 4.5 pounds. The one at Hyperspud was 2 pounds. Realizing that I could save myself 2.5 pounds with this one change led, of course, to the obvious conclusion I could take more books with me. Okay, on to the packs. The Aiken family, from the very beginning of their backpacking career, has been a fan of external frame packs. This is probably a result of our tendency to pull things out of our packs throughout the day and then to attach them somewhere on the frame until we needed them again. We were, all four of us, so taken with this method that we resembled a family of tinkers going down the trail, clothes blowing in the breeze and graniteware cups clinking against metal frames. Reluctant to change this habit, I was hoping to keep my old JanSport, bought at a time when only JanSport and Keldy continued to make external frame packs. 5 pounds. Let's try the top-opening Bergen rucksack I got in Norway. Nearly as big, but only 3 pounds. Okay, I'll use the Bergen and forego the convenience of all those nifty little zippered sections on the JanSport. On to the footwear. No decision there. I don't take one step without my Keen Newports. A fall with a horse years ago left me with a foot slightly misshapen with pins in it. If not treated with care and consideration, this foot will start to whine and eventually to howl its indignation. Because they are a sandal hybrid, the Keen Newports completely solve the foot problem and go one step farther. They keep away the gremlin of all hikers, the heat that causes blisters. And I have validation for the use of sandals from Chip Rollins, the co-author of The Complete Walker 4. Check it out. It's right there on page 78. Following the inventory, I was ready to return to Hyperspud. This time I talked to John, not the owner. With his help, we determined that the sleeping bag for me was the Western Mountaineering 6-foot Megalite with its lovely purple and black cover. Shuddering at the memory of my old mummy bag, I went for the version with 5 extra inches width at the shoulder. John then went methodically through all the virtues and vices of the various pads in the store. I decided I definitely wanted full length, not 3/4, and I really didn't want the hassle or worry of an inflatable pad, so I decided to stay with the old covered foam pad that I had at home. Now to the really, really fun part, poles. Remember Louise, who got this all started? Well, her son and daughter-in-law, Paul and Meredith, who have spent the last 10 years trekking all over the world, told us not to stir a foot without trekking poles. A quick check of the internet and the Sierra Trading Post catalog clued me into the prices on these. They are relatively expensive and vary considerably in features. I knew that I wanted to spend the minimum amount for what I needed, but hadn't a clue what it was I needed. So John, not the owner, spent a bit of time going over these features with me. The bits that I thought suited my needs were a second grip below the primary grip, which would allow me to shorten up while going uphill, the ability to adjust the lengths of the poles both for my use and for traveling, and extra tips that are rubber for paved surfaces, anticipating walking paved rail trails. The pair for me turned out to be Black Diamond Syncline with Flick Lock. What a great buy! I have come to view my poles with such affection that I never consider doing any walk without them. They lean against the wall next to the front door, ready to go on an instant's notice. They have become so familiar in my hands that I even find myself eyeing them when I only need to walk to the horse barn, all of 100 yards away across a level driveway. So now I have my sleeping bag and poles. The next item on the list was that most crucial piece of equipment for any walker, a pedometer. Don't laugh, I'm serious. My thought here is that I want to know how many miles I put on my Newports before they deteriorate. I once was told that serious runners never use a pair of shoes beyond 500 miles. Because a trek across Spain is exactly that distance, I will need to know how far a pair of Keens will go and therefore plan to carry an extra pair if needed. Here's the really great part about pedometers. You can pay $100 for one or you can pay $15. I love decisions like that. Now I'm at the great moment. What am I going to put into my bag for the women's writing and backpacking expedition? Or to address the real issue, what am I going to take back out? I start with the two givens. I'm using the top-loading Bergen bag, and the sleeping bag and clothes will go into the waterproof stuff sack. On first view, the stuff sack stuff looks too big for the bag. Don't panic, moving around a bit. Nothing works. So I'll have to take the slightly larger JanSport. A quick trial for fit leaves me with a good impression, except for the bar behind my head. I take that off, but now I've lost the space for my pad, and I have open ends to frame tubes. Strategic use of electrical tape covers the holes, but the pad strapped to the top without the bar resembles a bobblehead and still is able to push my hat forward until my eyes are covered. Suddenly, the wonderful foam pad is looking not so wonderful. Since the tent is already strapped below the bag, I have no other options without covering zippers that give me access to my things. A quick decision is needed here. I remember the air mattress folded into its little 4-inch by 6-inch sack at Hyperspud. On the shopping list it goes. Somewhere I have read that the best way to plan clothes for a trek is to start with the worst weather you expect and then to move on from there. This trip would go to an elevation of 8,600 feet, and we could expect cold rain and even snow, so I needed rain gear. Lined nylon pants with ankle zippers, old but not exactly cutting edge, but they can be pulled over lightweight fleece pants for cold weather. Jacket, I don't have one on the shopping list. Hat, only choice is the ball cap. It doesn't hit things on my back like my Tilly, and by putting my hair through the hole in the back, I control my hair and keep the hat on in the wind. Socks. This is where those waterproof socks come in. I've tried them with my Keens on a rainy day by walking through tall grass. My feet were completely dry and comfortable with no wrinkles or problem spots. Cold weather. Long sleeve Columbia nylon shirt, fleece cardigan, Bridgedale socks for evenings and if needed at night. Lightweight fleece pants can go on under shorts or under rain pants. Silk long underwear bottoms useful for mosquitoes in the evening. Heavyweight fleece pants. I really, really, really want to take these, but they are way too bulky for the pack. I suspect that the need to take them is more emotional than real. They go in the carrying it too far category. These are the things that you don't want to leave behind, so you throw them in the car and drive them to the trailhead and then leave them in the car there. Warm weather, nylon shorts, my favorite piece of clothing for walking, and cotton polo ditto. Underwear. Yay, I have enough room for a fresh pair of knickers for each day. Next, to find a spot are the 1-gallon Ziploc bags labeled toiletries, foot care, first aid, and household. Now back to Hyperspud, this time getting help from Zach. I find the rain jackets and spend a short moment in indecision about color. Is the bright yellow one, to which I am attracted, too obnoxious for moving through the backcountry in a quiet way? My decision almost went one way, and then it went the other. I got the yellow. Zach found the Big Agnes air pad for me, and then we had to discuss tents. In going through my equipment originally, I found that the poles to my two-man tent needed reshock cording, a task being done by the guys at Hyperspud. I was expecting to pick up the tent, but it wasn't ready because of additional problems. Uh-oh. I had a choice. I could plan to rent a tent at UI or buy a new one before the trip. I decided to buy. I really want one of those 3-pound jobs hanging from the ceiling. Since the old tent that I can't use weighs more than twice this amount, I somehow feel it is good that I have to buy this, even though I own a comfortable tent. I'm a little confused by this attitude. Is it rational or irrational? I know what my husband would call it, but I can't think about that now. I have a choice between two tents. One had the vestibule at the end, making it comfortable for lying inside and just reaching forward to have access to the pack. The other had the vestibule to the side, but had a peak high enough to allow sitting up inside. Zach wouldn't let me make a decision about which tent to buy until I climbed inside in order to personally experience the terror of being in such a confined space. Somehow, frightening claustrophobia feels better sitting up than lying down, so that made the decision, and I took home the MSR Hubba, as opposed to the 2-person version, which is the Hubba Hubba. Despite the haphazard approach to equipment acquisition, I am finally ready to pack up and head to the rendezvous point. It all fits in the pack, and I only have 2 items in the carrying it too far category, the heavy fleece pants and a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon. Leaving aside all the details of a fabulous 5 days with a wonderful group of people, spectacular scenery, great food, lovely hours of walking, and delightful moments around the morning and evening campfire, I will tell you how this equipment worked out. And I didn't have to write that part because I already had enough.
So Harriet didn't get to the part where she tells us how all the preparations worked out, but who cares? That was a great adventure in shopping. So that was Harriet Aiken starting us out on the right foot, so to speak, for this collection of writings from the women who took part in the backpacking and writing adventure that Carolyn Pachusel organized last fall. Not all the participants started writing early on like Harriet did. Some didn't start writing until, well, here's Odette Ingen.
You have to tell.
I did. I actually, I did write something. Not on the trip.
Okay.
Okay. I wish I had the scent of balsam to magically transport me back to Eagle Cap Wilderness. Back to a time and place so far from my life and responsibilities here in Moscow. It was 57 days ago, but it seems like longer. My refrigerator is plastered with pictures from our trip. The meadow we camped at, our first night and last, swamp lake, and a stream reflecting the morning light. Emily and I took a dip in Swamp Lake. We wore nothing. It was so refreshing. Ellen, Susan, and I took baths and washed our clothes, drying them on huge granite stones warm from the sunlight. The peppermint soap replacing the smell of our salty sweat. The sound of Ellen and Susan laughing like sisters with secrets. The sight of Katie in another yoga pose. The dance of Sheila's movements like a butterfly. The silent tear that escaped the bluest of eyes. The strength, the compassion, the kinship, the sisterhood, and the endless bags of gorp. These are the things I remember the most. I've almost forgotten the sore back, hips, and heels, the fire that branded perfectly good clothes. I'll never forget the feeling of my spirit filled to overflowing that lasted long past the winding road home.
Installment number 3 has been aired on Yin Radio earlier this winter, when the topic was the long, cold nights of solstice. The Wallowa Cap Wilderness is where the concept for the piece originated, and it's from Aaron Jepson, and it's called Night Vigil.
Night Vigil. Weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes in the morning. Psalm 30, verse 5. Last night was a long night. Stuck in a hotel in Hermiston, Oregon, the last place on earth I desired to be. I fought to open my eyes when once again one of my children woke and cried. They both have colds, so one or the other was awake every hour, all night long. Head aching, I lay thinking about the different nights in my life that seemed even longer than this one. The feeling of cold hits me first, bone-penetrating cold that chills even the memory of the night at Swamp Lake 6 weeks ago. I lay huddled in a borrowed sleeping bag, its unfamiliar contours limp against my shivering body. Fumbling with numb fingers, I pull the drawstring tighter around my face in a vain attempt to construct a better barrier between myself and the freezing night air. The rain begins. I hear it hitting the tarp above my face, the sound like tiny dancing feet, the sound of rain on the roof of an old trailer I slept in as I snuggled my weak old daughter on the couch all night, holding her body against my chest, my body heat the only thing keeping her tiny frame warm. Those raindrops danced above my head. They danced on the roof of a tiny rental in Fresno, the night I lay waiting for news that my mom had died. I was 11, my new baby sister, but 3 weeks old. The long hoped for and prayed for baby lay in her laundry basket crib because the new cradle was not yet done. How my mother hated placing her new tiny treasure in a laundry basket. And now she was dying. Her face had gone gray after dinner and she had to go lie down. That was hours ago, and I lay still in the dark in bed waiting for the phone to ring. The dark presses on my open eyes, staring up at the unseen silver underbelly of the red tarp. Not my tarp. Someone gave me the tarp for the night to keep the freezing rain off my sleeping bag, and I had stretched it tight, hoping its shelter would keep me warm that night. I am not warm. I am shivering with the deep, gut-tightening clenching that makes me wish I had not eaten any of the green soup I cooked for dinner. That soup churns in my shivering gut. Take my mind away. With the rain comes tears. They are my own rain. The tears are my wetness that the tarp cannot stop, and they coat the inside of the limp sleeping bag. I cry for my babies whom I miss desperately. I cry for the man I love who is far, far away. I cry for the loathing of the weakness that has once again betrayed me on the trail. I cannot stop the tears this time. As I lay in the dark long ago, I did not cry. I lay awake, listening to the baby in her laundry basket, breathing softly and waiting, waiting without tears, waiting for her to wake again, waiting for the phone to ring, waiting and trying not to see in my mind the face of my mother, drained of color, of her fainting slumped against the wall, of my dad's strong hands lifting her in her unsteady steps out to the car, of his hurried and jumbled words telling me nothing, of the words hospital and don't know and call you. Grandma will take care of you. I will call. I lay flat in the dark and waited. I lay on my back. Usually I sleep on my stomach. In a clinging cold bag, I cannot lay on my stomach and let the cocoon of sleep roll over me, so I lay on my back, my eyes open, staring at the cold as if it is something I can actually see instead of something I feel on my wet eyeballs. I lay on the ground, hard and cold and flat under my tarp, the red tarp in the dark that is not mine. I lay and wait for morning to come, for my salvation from the gut-churning cold and from missing my family. I lay and count the miles between me and home, home and warm, home and soft, and arms enfolding me, and small hands holding mine. So many miles, hundreds of miles, 1 mile for every minute of that interminable night. The minutes ticked by in the dark, and still the phone did not ring. I counted the miles, following in my mind the car as it drove to the hospital, wherever that was. The strong hands against my mother, and the brightly lit windows of the emergency room pouring their garish fluorescence out into the quiet night. The grayness of her face, the scratching of a pen against paper. More minutes crept by as I lay in the dark, on my top bunk, 3 weeks after my 11th birthday, listening to my baby sister breathe. The red tarp seems to breathe. Air sucks it in and out above me, and I watch it in my mind, in and out, concave, convex, concave. Dancing footprints of rain have gone away, and in their place is stillness. Quiet, the sound of outdoors, where lurks the small noises of animals, the sound of space, the sound of the cold, which is everywhere, not just in touch, but also in sound. The sounds ought to bring fear, but instead they bring comfort. In a world where sight is blurry and unpredictable, sound is my lifeline, and prayer is my lifeline. Counting the miles between myself and the ones I love, I know that God is with both, and the thought brings comfort. I know that my prayers, whispered between shivering lips, still salty with a coating of tears, will reach them via the one who loves them even more than I. Many a night my prayers have been sent heavenward, but never so despairingly as the night I waited for my mother to die, as I waited for a phone call, as I waited to know what was wrong. I prayed. I did not believe that the fervency of my prayers would make any difference to a God who already knew the answer to the questions in my heart, but it did not stop me from praying them. I trusted God with the unshakable faith of an 11-year-old child, but even then, I did not expect the answer to necessarily be yes. I hoped, oh yes, how I begged God, but I knew it often is no. I knew even then that God gives us no's, and I was preparing my heart, protecting my heart from what I knew might be coming. The phone call never came, but at last morning did. Light crept into the room. The baby woke and needed to be fed. My dad, the sort of person who does not call unless he has something to say, never called. Grandma and I fed the baby. We still waited. Dawn creeps in slowly after a cold night. It seems stiff and creaky like an old cat who stretches herself upon waking, long and slow, working each muscle in turn. I wait, knowing there were still hours to endure before breakfast and a fire. Light comes into my tarp reluctantly. Heat comes even more slowly. At last, voices. Someone is awake. I lay still, listening. Every sound made me look up, ears unconsciously waiting for news, for my dad, for a neighbor, something, anything. Without warning, the door opened and my dad came in. Tired. He wanted the baby, he said. He needed to take the baby to the hospital to my mom. No, Mom had not died in the night. No, they did not know what was wrong. The doctors were running tests. He needed the baby. He needed her clothes and diapers and a car seat. He looked tired. I have to force stiff limbs to move. Tears still hover close, and I don't want to take them down to the campfire where voices drift up to me on the blue haze of wood smoke. I push back the limp and slimy bag, half-heartedly extricating my aching limbs, my numb feet. I am now that cat. moving each stiff muscle as if I am swimming in syrup, thick and sticky and dragging at my body. I trudge a meandering path toward the voices. Voices hovered around me as I walked down the gray-carpeted hallway of the hospital. Hushed voices trickled from rooms beside me, breezy voices from behind me on the left where we had passed a nurse's station. I carried the three-week-old baby in my arms, her fiery red hair tousled against my shoulder, her warm limpness sinking into the crook of my elbow. Walking beside my towering father, I carried her carefully, looking up only when an old man passed us. "That your baby?" he asked. I shook my head no in wonderment and disgust. I was only 11. I still needed a mother myself. I was not the mother to the tiny bundle I carried. We arrived at her room. She lay in bed, on her back, like I had been while I waited. I did not cry as I handed the baby to her. I had not cried from fear, and I did not cry from relief now. She was alive, and she would live. She wasn't going to die, she explained to me. She'd almost died. There were blood clots in her legs, she said. She'd almost died when the ER doctor wanted to run a scope, but he hadn't done it. She'd almost died when the circulation had been completely cut off to both her legs, but she hadn't died. She would still have years of pain ahead, of therapy, of not being able to nurse my sister because of the blood thinners, of chronic fatigue from no circulation in her ruined veins. But she would live. She would live to watch my sister grow and to guide me through the turmoil of high school. A deep gratitude punctuated my prayers that night, knowing that God did not have to let her live. In the moment, gratitude feels as heartfelt for smaller things as it does years later for the larger. As I stand next to the fire at Swamp Lake, the gratitude fills me for the simple, life-sustaining warmth of sun, of fire, of people. Frost coats the slippery surface of rocks and the steep side of my red tarp. But it doesn't matter now. Every minute the sun reaches more of it, melting it away and warming the patches of grass. I still feel numb, outside and in, dreading the day's work ahead after a sleepless night, yet knowing that once I warm up, a kind of euphoria will hit, a triumph. It is over. The long, long night is over, and I made it. The long trek out looms ahead of me, but I know I will make it through that also. I am a different person than I was when I went to bed the previous evening, stronger and more vulnerable. This morning came all too quickly. My son, with his little nose running and his little whine unending, climbed up onto the hotel bed beside me. I asked and was informed that it was nearly 7. I knew in spite of my fuzzy brain that I needed to rise and begin my day, giving up hope of having any sleep. There was a family birthday party to attend, a 4-hour drive ahead with these same cranky children, and an evening event. No matter, it was morning, and whatever else the day held, it meant the long night was over.
This is Yin Radio, and today's show is called Explorations. It's about exploring the wilderness and exploring ourselves. It comes from 8 of the 11 women who were part of a women's backpacking and writing clinic last fall, where they went exploring in the Eagle Cap Wilderness in Oregon. Writing instructor for the group, Debbie Lee, reads next.
This is a piece that I actually started before the trip, and I actually worked on it the first and second night quite a bit, especially when we talked about segmenting. And it's a story called A Most Dangerous Place. It's about two different kinds of men. The first, my dad, who raised me and created for me an environment of absolute safety. And the second, a major professor I worked with in graduate school, a place where you assume absolute safety, but who attempted to take those things away. Plant, step, plant, step is what I'm saying as I walk the Grand Canyon South Rim. I'm aware of the tiniest lisp of breath on my lips as I say the word, and the hushed crunch of scree as I stab the trail with my hiking poles, and the rafters camp below on the northern bank of the Colorado River, and that their boats look like buttons from this height. Can they see me? Do they know how close I am to the edge? Do they know I can actually die? Wait, am I ready to die? Once I spent a year in London studying at the British Library and got so lonely I wanted to die. This is different. This is real. And I'm doing everything I can to keep from dying. My dad, who's ahead of me by 20 paces, calls out, "There's no room for error." And I wonder how he feels, wonder if this is why he's so attracted to wilderness, and of why, of all the places in Arizona we could be hiking, he picked the most dangerous, a remote trail called the Beamer that starts at Lava Rapids and winds along an exposure for miles until it reaches the Little Colorado. I know there's no room for error, but I don't call back. I can't afford to lose a second of concentration. Plus, I'm breathless. Isn't it weird? I'm breathless and aware of my breathlessness and thinking about the awarenessness of my breathlessness all at the same time. And I'm not afraid. Isn't that amazing? I really am not afraid. A few days earlier, on a sign at the trailhead, my dad and I had read about a young woman named Margaret Bradley who died in a place in the canyon called Cremation Drainage, where the estimated temperature was 120 degrees. She'd started off on a day trip without a map or enough food and water, so when she took the wrong trail, she was fatally ill-prepared. But my dad and I were prepared. We were hiking in mid-March, the safest time of the year in the canyon when temperatures don't rise above 80 degrees. Before we left our base camp that morning, we dressed in khaki pants, short-sleeve wicking shirts, and Asolo boots. We threw several bottles of water, 10 power bars, the topo map, a first aid kit, and a couple of headlamps into a day pack. What we didn't realize is that we'd be hiking on the extreme exposure of a crumbling trail, something neither of us had done before. A swallow dives a few feet before me, snatching up insects. She twists and twirls in the air and then cuddles into the canyon wall, reminding me that there's a parallel world here where one life form is safe and another is in great danger. One bird that doesn't live in the Arizona desert is the nightingale, but I associate it with the Grand Canyon State because I first learned the story of that bird at the University of Arizona in Tucson. I was sitting in the office of my professor and mentor, Terry. Terry looked a lot like my dad. They were men of the same era, average height and weight, light brown, nondescript hair. What did stand out about both was their intensity, the way they leaned toward you as they talked, like what they were saying right then was the most important thing in the world. I needed to know the story of the nightingale because I was specializing in John Keats for my PhD exam, and I would have a question about the poem whose origins I didn't know, the poem being Ode to a Nightingale. PhD exams are the final hurdle for graduate students. They're more stressful than anything else students endure during their graduate career. They make or break candidates. I'd already failed my exams once, and Terry was doing his best to build my confidence. Terry was the assistant dean at Arizona, serving under the renowned feminist Annette Kolodny, who was then the dean. So he never did have much time to sit and shoot the breeze. But every once in a while, he'd lean back in his chair and just talk. He told me one day that the nightingale was once a woman who'd suffered unbelievable pain. Her name was Philomela, and when she was a young woman, about the age I was at the time, her brother-in-law, Tiresias, drug her to the woods and raped her. Philomela cried for help. She cried for her sister. She cried for her father. She cried for the great and powerful gods. Her cries were not only useless, they were her undoing, for after Tiresias finished raping her, he cut out her tongue. It was this gruesome detail that sent me to Ovid, the first known written account of the story. And this is from Ovid. a translation. Teresia seized her tongue with pincers, and though it cried against the outrage, babbled and made a sound something like, "Father," till the sword cut it off, the mangled root quivered, the severe tongue along the ground lay quivering, making a little murmur, jerking and twitching, the way a serpent does run over by a wheel. And with its dying movement came to its mistress's feet. And a year went by, and what of Philomela? Guarded against flight, stone blocks around her cottage, no power of speech to help her tell her wrongs, her grief has taught her sharpness of wit, and cunning comes in trouble. She had a loom to work with, and with purple on white background, wove her story in and out, and when it was finished, gave it to one old woman with signs and gestures to take it to the queen. And so it was taken, unrolled, and understood. Terry told me that day how, after that, the gods transformed Philomela into a nightingale and gave her the most lovely and mournful voice in the animal kingdom. "I think we need to rest a while," my dad says. In my peripheral vision, he throws himself against the bank and grabs a spindly shrub. I get there and sit next to him. He wears a visor and I'm in a yellow bandana. We lean against the bank, stomachs taut and legs bent in a squat, our feet rooted to the trail. We're not safe. Stopping just gives us a chance to affirm to one another that we're still alive. "I don't know about this trail," he says. "Some of this mountain goats wouldn't even attempt." A few inches beyond our toes, the south rim drops 600 feet straight down. Across, the north rim looms, still snowy. I'd been on dozens of hiking trips with my dad, and I loved them because it was our father-daughter thing in a family where most things were father-son. I have three brothers and no sisters. When growing up, I learned to ride motorcycles and climb trees and talk about hunting and basketball, and more than once I lay in bed at night wishing I were a boy. It's not that I wanted a penis or had questions about my sexuality. I just felt like I'd fit into the world better if I were a man. My mom was pretty male-centered, too. A tomboy in high school, she loved horses and sports and camping more than clothes and cooking and entertaining. It was as if we were a family of boys. But that changed when we came of age. Each of my brothers took his place in the family plumbing business. I went to graduate school. And I'll just end it there.
And that was the group's writing instructor who trekked along with the women. There was another instructor who couldn't make the trip, although she did make it to the trailhead, and she wrote. Our next reader is that instructor, Andrea Clark Mason.
I wasn't able to go on the trip. You all know I camped at the trailhead the first night, and that was it. But I did the exercises at home. And I'm going to read to you one of the exercises. And it's pretty short, but this was Debbie's exercise, actually, about take some associations about, or it's rooted in refuge, which is over for sale over here, about some associations with a body of water and then writing a memory about your parents. This is called Maine, and it's obviously not about Swamp Lake. My parents watched the baby ducks, one, 2, 3, 4, 5. Small furry balls of yellow and brown floating behind the mother. "Look," my parents say, "they're so cute." Meanwhile, their two children are grown and gone, giving them the courtesy of one more trip to the lake. And these are short segments. Blank space. We canoe to the beach on Half Moon Island. We rest our canoe on the sand and wade to shore, knowing this is a side with leeches. We have red hot dogs to grill, and we wish the dog who swam laps in the lake was still alive. We build a fire on the beach and cook the red hot dogs on skewers. How long do we have? A storm is brewing. blank space. We take turns swimming, watching and swimming, feeling safe, unsafe. The lake we've known for so long, now dangerous, white caps. I remember how my brother jumped in to save me. I'm not sure how close I was to drowning, maybe not close at all, but that was the story we told, that he saved my life. Blank space. My great aunt sends me a birthday card with a hummingbird on the front, just like the hummingbirds that buzz around the outside of her camp in Maine. My great aunt bathes in the lake. It is a familiar image, her white plastic bathing cap decorated with fake flowers. She uses a bar of soap. Now, I can't help but think that one of the last great bodies of water is polluted with her soap. Instead, I'll try to remember the water that is wide, flat, forgiving. And then I happen to have this in my purse. So I was thinking I'd just read a short excerpt of an essay that is about moving west and wanting to hike and sort of be part of the West. This is from an essay called The Real West. And it's about, I guess, my early 20s when I was sort of in the process of moving west. And my first stop was Boulder, Colorado. In Boulder, the Flatirons rose sharp and straight out of the Colorado foothills. We collected our drinking water from El Dorado Springs. The scenery just out of town was cliffs and snow-peaked mountains, and I finally felt, as I walked around along our canyon road next to Four Mile Creek lined with wildflowers, that I was getting somewhere. Sure, I worked a 9-to-5 job in a gray cubicle, and I spent most of that time photocopying manuscripts, but at least I lived in a dramatic canyon outside a western town. At the top of the mountain that backed up against our house was a nature preserve. It was rumored that there had been a cougar attack there, a small boy who ran ahead of his parents. I was no longer in safe suburbia. Walking abandoned logging roads in the backwoods of Idaho, where I might glimpse a moose and all I can see in every direction are cedars and ponderosa pine, is not anything like when I used to run the Mount Sanitas Trail outside Boulder and see recreators talking on their cell phones, walking dogs on leashes, and wearing the latest trail running shoes. Although I knew when I walked the path at Mount Sanitas that it was something like what I was looking for, fields of wildflowers, sharp rocks rising out of the earth, there were houses in the distance that wealthy Boulderites had built. And even though this was Rocky Mountain scenery instead of the deciduous trees I was used to back east, in many ways it wasn't so different from the park where my mom used to take our dog in suburban Philadelphia. That sense of development, of cuteness, of tame nature was what I wanted to escape. I wanted to feel wild. The only way I knew how to do that was to live in a place that felt wild as well.
Now, trip organizer and instructor of the backpacking portion of the trip is Carolyn Pachuzel. Here's Carolyn reading first her work, a poem called Breath and Soul, and then she reads the work of fellow explorer who wasn't able to attend the reading, Katie Schussler.
This is a poem called Breath and Soul. It begins with a cold, starry night camped beside the Lostine River. She murmurs to herself as she dances down the mountains. I fumble with my tent pole and my chest seizes in terror. Breathe. The sun is climbing towards his perch in the sky, and dewdrops on delicate pink petals promise renewal. A little hiking lifts my burden. I breathe in. Pure, still water reflects jagged granite peaks. Naked, I feel vulnerable and free. I breathe out. More dead branches to feed the fire, surrounded by 10 warm women, 10 different stories. I absorb them in the warmth with wonder. We breathe together. Snow plops down from the black sky, and by the morning, the mountain meadow is white. My fingers ache with cold as I snap the sternum buckle closed against my chest. hiking down the mountain, our breaths trail behind us, laughing. This was written by Katie Schussler, who was another participant, and she's in Eugene, so I'm reading it for her. It's called Smoke and Paper. I don't remember the year the fires came and took the trees and houses from the top of Mount Lemmon. I was absorbed in bookmaking, signature binding, gluing Davy board to cloth. You didn't know it, but I wanted to quit smoking. Smoke from the fires billowed up like a ghost, the monster from my conscience, intimidated and frightened and familiar. One morning, I thought a monsoon was coming, and my bookbinding friends glanced out the window. No, it's fires on Mount Lemmon, they corrected me nonchalantly, turning attention back to sewing pages together. It was monsoon season, and I made a tiny accordion book about the weather. It was easy to do, didn't require much. As the fires raged on, I cut and glued blurry photographs, perfect squares. The final page was a rainbow, a blurt of brilliance crammed into a 2x2-inch accordion. Quitting meant so much to me, to let go but to grab something new, a reach into the unknown, the switch from pessimism to optimism. You were gone then. Where? Making movies? Sitting in trees? Carefully and late one evening, I transferred your image to a fancy piece of paper. The printing press squeaked as I cranked the handle, squeezing your image onto the page, the orange solvent stinging my nose. You didn't know it, but I had also carved your face on a woodblock, bobbing down a river like a memory, gushing with red and black ink. I heard from Steph that you passed the bar and you're working at the hot dog cart, just like old times. Your face lives on in smoke and paper.
That was trip organizer Carolyn Pachuzel reading Katie Schussler's piece, Smoke and Paper. Now, all the pieces on today's Yin Radio show come from the women who participated in last fall's backpacking and writing trip. It's called Exploring the Wilderness, Exploring Ourselves. This last installment is from Susan Ross. Susan used the writing assignments and the outdoor inspiration to draw out her memories of three generations. Here's Susan Ross.
All right, I did start this on the hike. I've been working on it a little bit since with some help from Debbie and from Peter. So I'm tentatively calling it Three Generations. As I hike out, Swamp Lake lies molten in the sun, tranquil and luminous. Cumulus clouds kiting overhead skate across unruffled water. The lake in Maine is rarely this calm. Sometimes at 5 a.m., before the sun crests the trees by the Alden camps, and the warming air begins to rise, sighing through the pines and stirring wrinkles into the lake, I can glide soundlessly, watching the pike dart into the depths away from the red bow of the canoe. Or sometimes, quite late in the evening, when clouds blinker the stars and prevent the cold air from sifting earthward, the loons circle and dance, their mournful cries bouncing between the plate glass lake and leaden roof in a litany of echoes. On a night like that, we kids came home from across the lake, where your vodka-slurred accusations and scotch-laden anger sliced through the murmurs of the adults in deck chairs just beyond the porch. Back from our interrupted game of rummy, we sat sullenly on the dock and turned to watch you lurch down the stairs screaming, "I'm leaving you." The entire lake heard. They heard when you tripped on the dock, sending your glasses sailing irretrievably free to sink with a hollow plunk. For one eternal instant, your pianist's fingers played the air, and now unsighted eyes tried to read the dark terrain. Then you crashed face first into the bottom of the aluminum boat tied up some 4 feet below, and he stood over you bellowing obscenities. "Damn you, Polly," your new husband screamed, shifting his weight from foot to foot as if tossed on a rough sea. It took several minutes for any of us kids to climb down into the boat to find you, face gashed, front teeth missing, in a puddle of blood in your own urine. In the end, you broke your nose and several ribs, I think. Now, as the sun scents the air with spruce and hemlock, I hike under a different leaden sky, climbing a series of switchbacks out of the alpine basin that cradles Swamp Lake. A field of snow, blushing red from algae bloom, crowns the north-facing cliff of the Cirque that plummets some 700 feet through wildflower-studded alluvial gravel, granite behemoths, and tortuously sculpted evergreens. Grassy hummocks punctuate the south end of the lake that reclines below, like some Japanese garden etched from a skirt of rich green turf. When I pause too long to catch my breath and gaze farewell, the edge of the breeze cuts through my fleece, a sharp foretaste of an Oregon winter and a reminder of the rime that iced my tent this morning. My breath is strained here at 8,300 feet. Even when I slow to a matrimonial stutter step, I tend to gasp. But the pack is a now familiar afterthought hugging my back. I ration my water as your mother rationed her love, doling it out in carefully measured servings, never quite enough to slake the need. She, of course, would say she feared spoiling you, as though too much love would forever taint and maim you. I think you said it was the summer you turned 11, the year you got the curse, as you always described it, that she sent you off to camp in the hills of New Hampshire, away from your brother and your best friend, Siggy. I can almost hear her crisp consonants as she told you it was high time you made some friends, spent some time out of doors, learned some independence. Her plan was for you to spend 10 weeks. But just as she was settling into the cabin at the Cape, the camp nurse called and told her to come and fetch you immediately. You had the chicken pox. She said that was preposterous, totally unacceptable. A change of plans is simply out of the question, she declared, and summarily dismissed the nurse. Somehow you managed to get in touch with your mother's baby sister. Your Aunt Cheryl rushed down to swoop you up to recuperate with her on the rocky coast of Maine. Cheryl dedicated her college vacation to nursing you. Your parents didn't visit. For 2 weeks, you lay in bed, unable to walk the 4 blocks to the wharf for fried clams or a lobster roll. I must have been 4 or 5 when you first told me the story of those happy days in Castine. Wakened each morning to the cadence of the midshipmen marching down Pleasant Street to duty on the state of Maine. It was Cheryl, too, who later rescued me. Her eyes silenced us, your brother and me, as our dance of angry words spun out of control. Turning to me, Cheryl said, "You know what's wrong with this damn family? We're too damned inbred. Your dad was the first hint of new blood we'd seen in generations, and we ran him off. Ruined Polly's life, you know." Then she tossed back her tumbler of scotch and strode out on the porch to watch the setting sun gild Penobscot Bay. Today, at day's end, I pitch camp where the Lostine River shuffles in slippered feet across a smooth stone bed. At meadow's edge, the drowsy river nudges leaves into the elbows of a fallen limb. The sun sinks early behind the peaks of the Wallawas. Ice is in the air. And as I fill my canteen, the water bites with snow-cold teeth.
Higher, 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 higher it's all full of love and hope and the courage to make you strong. And these are the things I wish for you, that the grass is always green and the skies are purest blue, that the mountains soar with their beauty so serene, and the oceans remain their iridescent.
I'd like to thank the participants in the Exploring the Wilderness, Exploring Ourselves Women's Backpacking and Writing Trip for today's show, with special appreciation to Carolyn Pachuzel, Debbie Lee, and Andrea Clark Mason. If you'd like to hear past shows or podcast this show, you can do that at yinradio.org. And that is where you can also sign up for our electronic newsletter, and you can find out what's going on at Yin Radio. You can also find Yin Radio at MySpace and on Facebook. Now, let us know what you think of Yin Radio, please, for good or for bad. What do you want to hear less of on the show? What do you want to hear more of? And what are we just plain missing out on that we need to cover? Drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and it's heard on a number of stations in the U.S. of A, including KYRS Spokane, Washington. That's 92.3 and 89.9, and KYRS.org. I'm your producer and host, Sandy Billings, and I'm glad you joined me. Until next week.
You mean everything to me.